This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On the face of it, the arrest of the wealthiest man in Russia might look like a long overdue effort to rein in the so-called oligarchs, a small group of men who became fabulously rich buying up pieces of the old Soviet economy at bargain prices. But most observers see more politics than justice behind the charges and worry that the government's tactics show an ominous preference for Kremlin control. Mikhail Khodorkovsky faces 10 years in prison if he's found guilty on charges ranging from theft of state property to tax evasion. He's the chairman of the giant Yukos oil company, or at least he was until he resigned from his prison cell today. His arrest and the seizure of a huge chunk of Yukos shares triggered a plunge on the Russian stock market and a flight of foreign capital. So which forces are behind what appears to be a power struggle in Moscow? How will this Yukos affair affect Russia's economic growth and its stability and the prospects for democracy? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. In this hour, we're going to talk about the political wrangling in Russia, what it means for the country's future, and its fallout on world markets. But first, we want to start to get a better sense of who this jailed oligarch is. Financial Times deputy editor Chrystia Freeland spent 2 days shadowing Khodorkovsky in late September, and she joins us now from the FT's offices in London, and it's good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
It's a pleasure.
Khodorkovsky, what is he like?
Well, he's actually in person quite a mild-mannered, quiet guy. He's not showy. He's not loud. He's actually, within his company, known for being a little bit more low-key than is maybe the standard practice for a Russian manager. I first met him in the 90s, before he became sort of wildly rich and successful. And in those days, you would even call him reclusive. He was really quite shy. So that's the kind of person he is, just as a human being.
How did he get to be so fabulously wealthy?
There were a number of different steps. I would say the first and important step for Khodorkovsky was he began being involved in business during that Gorbachev period in the late 80s when things first started opening up. And Khodorkovsky in those days was a well-behaved communist apparatchik. In university, he was a Komsomol official. That was the Communist Youth League. Mm-hmm. And in that capacity, they sort of said, hey, Misha, why don't you go start a business? That's sort of what everyone's doing, and we want some loyal kids to get involved. So that was the first step. In the early 90s, he then got involved in banking operations. He did all kinds of stuff, you know, importing computers, setting up a cafe. But the really lucrative thing was various banking operations, which, because of the chaos of that period, if you were smart, if you were well-connected, you could make a lot of money. And then the real breakthrough moment, the thing that transformed him from just a millionaire into a billionaire, was this very Byzantine privatization process called the Loans for Shares, in which basically a handful of Russian businessmen were given control of Russia's natural resources in exchange for supporting Yeltsin in the presidential elections. Khodorkovsky was one of the lucky ones, and that's what made him a billionaire.
Now, after the Yeltsin period ended and Mr. Putin came to power, it was widely reported that he made a deal with the oligarchs. Basically, the state would not look into the rather shady conditions under which they acquired their fabulous fortunes as long as they did not mess with politics.
That's exactly right. One of the things that was really, I would say, Putin's first priority, and I interviewed him a few months after he became president, and it was very clear that one of the things that was really important for him was to put an end to this rather incestuous relationship between the oligarchs and the state. He called them in for a meeting. None of us were present at that meeting, but most of the people there have said that they reached this sort of bargain that you described, where the oligarchs could keep their money, but they had to stay out of politics.
And Mr. Khodorkovsky did not keep his end of the bargain.
That would certainly be Putin's understanding of it. I think the way Khodorkovsky sees it is that he agreed that his company as a company would not play a role in politics. His view, though, is that as a citizen, as a human being, like anybody else, he thinks that he should have a right, and he insists upon having a right, to be involved in politics, to fund political parties, and so on. And that is, I think, the nub of the current conflict.
Now, it's also the fact, I guess, that Yukos, this gigantic oil company that he ran, though it's the conditions of its acquisition may be dubious, he nevertheless transformed it into perhaps the most transparent of the big companies in Russia today.
That's exactly right. For those of us who followed Russian business in the 90s, the transformation of Yukos was really something incredible to watch. Like a lot of other Russian companies, Yukos in the mid to late 90s was seen as a pretty tough operator. Its minority investors, especially Western ones, felt pretty bruised and were not saying nice things about the company. What was remarkable about Khodorkovsky was that over the past 5 years, he really managed to turn the company around. Once he managed to acquire full control over the company, he set about making it transparent, having Western-style accounts. He publicly announced what his own shareholding was, and he did a good job within the company on straightforward management issues like lowering his costs of production of oil.
Now, you interviewed him just a little bit before his arrest. What did he say? The government's campaign against him had already been launched some months earlier. How did he describe what was at stake?
He was a little bit careful in terms of talking about who was behind the campaign. He didn't want to say, for example, that this was something that President Putin himself had personally launched. Having said that, in Khodorkovsky's mind, this was very much a fight about Russian politics and the shape of the Russian polity. In his view, there were forces in Russia, forces close to the president, who were very keen to push Russia back towards authoritarianism, forces that were not tolerant of pluralism and of dissent in the political space. And Khodorkovsky saw himself as someone who represented a threat to those forces because he's rich and he's independent. And he had shown that he was interested in funding civil society projects and in funding opposition political parties.
Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And let's take a call from Chris, who's with us from Baldwinsville, New York.
Yeah, hi. I got a question relating to the company that he was trying to sell the Russian oil company to. It wasn't Enron, was it?
Christia Freeland, what was in the works for Yukos?
Yukos was and probably still is in discussions with two big U.S. oil companies, Exxon Mobil and Chevron Texaco.
And isn't there a merger underway with another Russian company, or at least being considered?
Yes, a merger has almost been completed between Yukos and a company called Sibneft.
Now, the proposed, is this a partnership with these big American companies or an outright sale?
I think that it's still too early to know for sure. Those discussions were still at a very, very preliminary phase before Mr. Khodorkovsky was arrested, and it's still impossible to say what impact his arrest has had on those discussions. It's kind of hard to do business with a guy who's in jail, obviously.
But the almost complete merger, as far as I was reading, that might make Yukos one of the top five oil companies in the world.
That's right. That's right. Even without a deal with a Western company, Yukos Sibneft is, it depends on how you count it, but it's about number four or five.
Chris, thanks very much.
Okay, thank you.
One final question for you, Christia, and that is about this gentleman's political ambitions. He was seen to be dropping hints that he might run for president in 2008.
Some people have said that. I think a more credible scenario is that Khodorkovsky was hoping to become prime minister. The reason it had seemed to me that that was more credible is because being president is a directly elected position. And I think that as an oligarch, as someone who's Jewish, Khodorkovsky's electability is probably pretty questionable in Russia. The prime minister is chosen by members of parliament, so I think that would be more realistic. After the campaign against Yukos began, Khodorkovsky stopped really talking about any personal political ambitions, realizing that that could only intensify the Kremlin's hatred of him. But it is true that in the spring he was hinting at those sorts of things.
And I lied. One more question. He is now in prison. He now faces charges that could land him in jail for 10 years. He's now resigned his job. Is he done?
It's really hard to say. I think that Khodorkovsky's resigning his job does not necessarily mean that he has decided to surrender. He is, after all, not just someone with political ambitions. He's Yukos's biggest shareholder. And having the company's boss in jail has not been good for the company's share price. Since Khodorkovsky resigned, the share price went up more than 8%. And Khodorkovsky is the primary financial beneficiary of that. So I think that he is still going to be fighting. How successful he can be from his prison cell, we'll have to see.
Thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Chrystia Freeland is the deputy editor of the Financial Times, the author of Sale of the Century, Russia's Wild Ride from Capitalism to Communism. She joined us today from the Financial Times studios in London. And here with us in Studio 3A is Andrew Meyer. He's the author of the new book, Black Earth, A Journey Through Russia After the Fall, a former Time magazine correspondent in Moscow. And thanks very much for coming in today.
Good to be here.
And I wanted to ask you a question. Much of your book involves travels to the various corners of the old Soviet Union and parts of the new Russia. This kind of conflict that's underway in Moscow, how much do people around the country of Russia pay attention to it these days? Is this a vital issue there?
Well, they'll certainly be watching it on the evening news, in the sense that the only news that covers one corner of Russia to the other is the state channel. Does it affect their daily concerns and their cares to a lesser extent? However, this is certainly a factor in the thinking of the Kremlin. In playing out the arrest of Khodorkovsky and the seizure of the shares, they're certainly playing on a hope that the common man, the common woman, will think at the end of the day, well, they're doing something right. There'll be very few tears shed for Mikhail Khodorkovsky, or for that matter, for any oligarch in Russia.
And it's not to be overlooked that there are parliamentary elections due up in, what, a couple of months?
Yeah, December 7th.
And then we have the presidential election in the spring.
Well, as I say in Moscow, and I was there last month, scheduled for next spring.
Scheduled for next spring. So at the same time, there is widespread, as you're suggesting, resentment of these oligarchs who a lot of people think stole the state assets and got away with it.
Well, I think you need to do a couple of things. One thing, you need to back up and try to get some perspective on what's happened in the last 10 years in Russia. You know, we had the Great Depression in this country. The economic decline in Russia since the fall of the Soviet Union has been at least threefold, some say many more times, than what we suffered in this country. The average Russian, it's a horrible term, I don't like using it, but the people that I tried to meet with and talk with in my book have suffered a tremendous amount and have endured a great deal. They continue to. Many of the oligarchs and some of the mini oligarchs have actually privatized whole regions of Russia. So when you travel around, you find this very strange phenomenon when someone can be living very poorly in a remote corner of Siberia, and yet they can say the most wonderful things about a particular oligarch in Moscow who flies in once in a while and stays in the best hotel, and they never even see him. Why? Because before the oligarch privatized that region, hospitals were not running well, schools were not working well, buses were old, streets were unpaved. So in many ways, the oligarchs stepped in into a social where there was no social infrastructure, where the state had collapsed. And the oligarchs were providing funds and material needs for people who were in desperate need of them. However, the traditional Russian response to the rich is not a good one.
So these guys are I guess, modern-day equivalents of grand dukes or barons?
Well, they'd like to call themselves, you know, Carnegies and Rothschilds. They'd like to say that we are the robber barons. However, most of them, including the most shining example, Mr. Khodorkovsky, up until his arrest, that is, had done in a matter of years what the robber barons did in generations.
We're talking about the political and economic fallout after the arrest of Russia's richest man. If you're curious about how Russia got to this point or where the country goes from here, give us a phone call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can send us email, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're discussing recent news out of Russia, where the arrest of the nation's richest tycoon is exposing underlying tensions in the government of President Vladimir Putin. You're invited to join our discussion. Our number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address, TOTN at NPR.org. Our guest here in Studio 3A is Andrew Meyer, the author of Black Earth, A Journey Through Russia After the Fall. And let's get another caller on the line. And this is Jane, who's with us in Newtown, Pennsylvania.
Hello.
Hi, you're on the air.
Yes. My question is, the woman that you had before, mm-hmm. she seemed very sympathetic to the gentleman that got arrested. What is she basing that on? I mean...
Well, she's no longer with us on the line.
The question is I'm ex-Soviet Union. I've been here a long time, and I'm still in touch with people in Russia and here. And a lot of money from this country goes to back to Russia to support, like you said, regular people there.
Mm-hmm.
And the gentleman's talking now, absolutely right. There is no love lost for the oligarchs.
The oligarchs.
You've no oligarch. You've created a new word there. They've been called oligarchs and plutocrats.
Sorry.
But oligarch is a very good one.
Yeah. Mm. And yes, they act like robber barons, but I mean, they sure stole enough money from Russia and send it out to Swiss banks and offshore banks. I mean, literally raped the country.
Yes. So you will not shed any tears for him?
Absolutely not.
Does the behavior of the government in this crisis, and that's caused some people to express some concerns about, controlling the media and heavy-handed, arrests with, commandos jumping aboard aircraft and that sort of thing. Does the government's behavior in all of this give you any pause?
Very much so, but it's something that really can be controlled right now. Putin is in charge, and it's going to stay that way for a while. I mean, Russian people are very, what's the word? It's, I talked to somebody and was very upset when the glasnost came in, and I said, why? He says, it's crap, but it's the same crap. It's familiar. And that's kind of the theory. It's like once you get set in one kind of settings, they like to stay there. And it's going to be a while before it's going to change again.
Okay, Jane, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the phone call. Andrew Meyer, her reaction similar to what you reported amongst, common amongst a lot of people. What do you see as being at stake here? Is this just a power struggle between two groups of mutually exclusive, small elites?
Well, for the last couple of years, I think, when Putin first came in, the big question was, who is Mr. Putin? And both in Moscow and in the West, people had a hard time answering that question. He quickly set about doing a number of extreme measures. He called them reforms. Other people called them a rollback. There's no question, though, now that screws were certainly tightened with free press in terms of... of course, the war in Chechnya, which is what he came to the Kremlin on, and it continues to this day. There's no question of that. At the same time, in my trips back to Moscow in the last few years, the overriding sense has been one of stagnation. And whether you were a banker or a bus driver, people were talking about, we have zastoy, which is the Brezhnev years, mm-hmm. stagnation, what the last caller was talking about. Putin's in power. He's there for a long time. So be it. We better get through the day. There was a sense that the spoils had already been divvied up. What you're seeing now is essentially a real dogfight between the people around Putin and the oligarchs. There are a number of factions in between, many oligarchs, and plays out on every level, the federal, the regional, down to the village. But the music has been set by Mr. Putin, there's no question. And in my book, I talk about really sort of, I think it was a pivotal speech made after the arrest of the first oligarch, Vladimir Gusinsky, who was the head of the first independent media empire. And it was a speech made by a man named Sergei Derenko, who had a nickname called the Telekiller. He was the television killer because he was on air on state television, which was controlled by the arch oligarch, then the now fallen Boris Berezovsky. And Derenko went on the air the night that Gusinsky was arrested, and he spoke with eloquence. I don't think he'd ever spoken without a script before. And he suddenly spoke eloquently about these robots and the music that they were hearing, and that we, in this last decade since the Soviet fall, had thought that the robots had all been thrown away on the ash heap of history. And yet they hear this music, Putin's music, and they've all woken up and they're surrounding us. That started in June of 2000 and it continues to this day.
So that leading to the theory that it's the old KGB, the Czechists, as they're sometimes called, that is rallied around Vladimir Putin?
Well, that's on the sort of the level of the prosecution. And on the level, on the more, I think, if we step back, there's a fight for the future of Russia going on, and it's happened since Yeltsin stood on the tank. It's, you know, I had an interesting talk with a Moscow banker this week, and I asked him, you know, what's going on? What's your sense? And he said, look, it's not about the share price, the stock market, any of the, you know, the minutiae of all of this. Step back and talk about the moral chaos. And it's actually one of the things I try, the thread that runs throughout my book. I went to Chechnya, I went to Norilsk, which is a region controlled by another oligarch, one of the survivors, Vladimir Potanin. And I went to Sakhalin in the east and to Petersburg. In each region, I focus on a different story. But the overriding question is, how does Russia get through this moral chaos? And Mr. Putin has a very different perspective than the oligarchs, certainly than Mr. Kharkovsky. And I talked to this banker about it, and he said, you know, I was in South Africa. And South Africa went through a truth and reconciliation process, as other countries in the world have. Russia never has. And he put the question to Kharkovsky, can we look back? Can we revisit the sins of the past? Mr. Kharkovsky said no. Hmm. And that's exactly what Mr. Putin is trying to do now.
Joining us now from his home in Moscow to talk about the political fallout from the arrest is Sergei Markov. He's the head of the Russian Center for Political Studies, a Kremlin-connected think tank. And thanks very much for staying up to be with us tonight.
Thank you.
The immediate casualty of this arrest, politically speaking, was Mr. Putin's chief of staff, Alexander Voloshin, who resigned in protest last week. He was widely viewed as being a pro-business presence on the president's staff. Will his absence change the nature of the president's office and his presidency?
Partly, yes. Look at this from different point of view. I think that Alexander Voloshin play very important role in the functioning of political regime last few years. And Alexander Voloshin was one of the principal organizers of this political regime, and he was the center and the mind of this regime. He deal with media, political parties, parliament, governors in the most sensitive issues, like, for example, a referendum in Chechnya. He also was very influential on the most important direction of Russian foreign policy. For example, he paid a lot of attention to the Russian policy toward the United States and toward Ukraine, the biggest post-Soviet country. And the fact that Alexander Voloshin will be not there means that Vladimir Putin political mechanism will be will have some problem now, but it's a problem of functioning, of well-functioning, a problem of effectivity of this political mechanism. Those people who come instead of Alexander Voloshin, they are, in fact, not specialists in political techniques, not specialists in elections. They are just worse. Maybe it's good for this new task, but it's clear that these people will be not able to do such job which have been done by Alexander Voloshin. And if we look from ideological point of view, I think there are no difference. Alexander Voloshin was very liberal. I would say even a radical liberal. He think, for example, that most of the European countries have socialist economy, and American economy also has a lot of socialist signs. He wants Russia to have more liberal economy than economy in the United States, and of course, much more liberal than in the Europe. But people who replace him, they also young. Liberals. All three guys, Dmitry Medvedev, Dmitry Kozak, and Igor Shuvalov, they are very young, very bright, they are lawyers, and of course they think that Russian
Russian future is liberal economy and liberal policy. And by the way, I remember that I spent a few months together with Igor Shuvalov in American University. In fact, it was the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Where we study law, and I'm political science. And so from ideological point of view, it will be no change. But from point of view of who is these people professionally, what they are going to do professionally, it will be different. These all three people are lawyers, and all of them, all three of them specialists on administrative reform. During few periods, Dmitry Medvedev has been head of special commission on administrative reform in the presidential administration. Dmitry Kozak has been head of special commission on administrative reform in the Council of Russian Governors. And Igor Shuvalov has been head of special commission on administrative reform in the Russian Cabinet of Ministers. So, as a result, I think their role will be not political techniques and maneuvering how to deal political regime, but more administrative reform and implementation of law.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Sergei Markov is head of the Russian Center for Political Studies. He was with us by phone from his home in Moscow. Still with us here in Studio 3A is Andrew Meyer, who's the author of Black Earth. And let's get back to the phones and go to Ryan, and Ryan's with us from International Falls in Minnesota.
How you guys doing?
Okay,
good.
I just some of the comments that I would like to make are the fact that GDP growth in Russia itself is about twice over the last 3 years, about twice what the Western European and United States, Canada, you know, basically the rest of the developed world is doing. The fact that their cell phone usage as it, because they don't, you know, they aren't pulling wires and going old technology. They're, you know, they're going to just basically all cell phones, just like China is. You know, 3 years ago, there was about 10 million people in Moscow with a cell phone. It's now up to 40%. I mean, if you saw that going on, that kind of growth going on in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, you know, in our top markets, you would see companies not going through the financial crisis that they've seen, you know, over the last 3 years.
It sounds like you've got some expertise, Ryan.
I actually work for a mutual fund company that has a Russia fund. And believe it or not, the our Russia fund is actually the number two over the last 5 years of all mutual funds, all 14,000 funds.
Well, along with that growth that you're talking about, a part of the equation is stability. Does the arrest of Mr. Khodorkovsky and the seizure of a huge block of stocks in his company, does that give you pause?
Well, ironically, Yukos is actually our number one holding. It's close to 20% of the portfolio. It dropped down the total share price by about 15% on the year-to-date number, and it actually came back up over the last, Thursday and Friday, it came back up a little bit.
Right.
Friday was a pretty good day. But I think if you look at the other oil companies and you look what Yukos was doing, the fact that it is a pure political play, and what I was telling your producer is that, you know, the fact that our country would not be where it is today without the Rockefellers, without, U.S. Steel, without the ultra, ultra rich controlling a lot. They had to. They had to base, you know, you have to start somewhere, you know, when your market just goes basically to zero. I mean,
you're listening to Talk of the Nation, which is coming to you from NPR News. Andrew Meyer, quick response to that?
I would just love, I was going to ask Ryan what his fund put out to its investors. Most of these funds have put out some major alarm bells in the last few days that if I were an investor would scare the daylights out of me. You talk to bankers and brokers in Moscow, and they're very good at talking their own book. The market has been phenomenal in the last year after the crash of 1998. But I think the smartest investors there know that it's been overheated for a long time.
Well, joining us now to talk about just how risky it might be is Alex Bredow. He's a Russia analyst with the Eurasia Group, a global consulting and risk analysis company. He's with us from our bureau in New York. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Has this, particularly the seizure of the stocks, has this shaken investors?
Well, I think we saw some initial concern on the markets, certainly late last week, as there was a lot of uncertainty initially as to exactly what the government was doing. And I think when it became clear that the government was, at that point, freezing rather than seizing the assets, that there was a little bit of a calming down. And one of the interesting aspects of what the Kremlin has been doing is trying to calm down Western investors in terms of what's going on, to try and tell them that this is not about renationalization or taking away or breaking apart Yukos, that this is about one person or a group of shareholders at the company.
Well, what are you telling your clients? Is it a good time to invest in Russia?
Well, you know, some of the issues that that we look at concern the political risk inherent in the situation, and one of the things that's become clear is that a lot of what's going on is related to the political environment in the country, just being 4 to 5 weeks away from the Duma parliamentary elections in December. This has created a lot of political volatility in the country, and there is the potential for more of that going forward. However, when you start looking out towards the medium term, there become questions as to, you know, just how much these political tensions will ease. And it seems to an extent that that they will start to calm down after the Duma elections, which are much more contentious politically than the presidential elections, which seem to be much more of an easier victory for President Putin.
Well, thanks very much, Alex. Appreciate you coming in today.
Thank you.
Alex Bredow is a Russia analyst with the consulting firm the Eurasia Group. He was with us from our bureau in New York. And in the minute we have left, Andrew Meyer, where is this likely to go? Are the stakes as big as some people are playing them out to be?
I think one thing that's interesting so far in the reports that I've read is the lack of a real response from the West. When Vladimir Kuczynski, the oligarch I mentioned before, the media baron, when he was arrested, everyone had the level of free speech to talk about. And the White House and the State Department spoke up very fast. Strobe Talbott was then Deputy Secretary of State, said, "Mr. Putin, this," I'm paraphrasing, "this does not resonate rule of law. It resonates intimidation." Unfortunately, so far, we've had nothing but silence from the Bush White House. And I think that we'll have to see how it plays out next and getting some directions more from Western capitals.
Thanks very much for coming in today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank
Andrew
you.
Meyer is the former Time magazine correspondent in Moscow and the author of the new book, Black Earth, A Journey Through Russia After the Fall. He joined us here in Studio 3A. We've been talking about the future of Russia. Coming up after the break, a look at the Chechen rebels and one journalist's story of trying to cover their side of the conflict. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.